My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Let's talk.
John Brown. Hermann Bark is Hitler's forgotten general. Though less famous than Rommel or von Manstein, Hermann Bark was considered by peers and enemies to be among the most talented German commanders of the Second World War. It is the subject of a fascinating new book. If you know me, you know how much I like this particular period of history. So I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by the author of Hitler's Forgotten General, Philip K. Buzak. Good morning to you, Philip. How are you doing?
Yes, good morning from Sussex. Yep, not too bad. Sun shining.
Very nice part of the world too. If you were to say to people, name a German general, they will go Rommel. Simple as that. He is, he is the rock and roll star of the Wehrmacht. Maybe they'd say Kessling at a pinch if they kind of knew what they were talking about. Tell me a little bit about who exactly Hermann Bark is. Is he a Prussian? Is he, just to give me a little bit of 101 if you can.
Yeah, I mean, like virtually 50% of the senior officers of the German army before it became the Wehrmacht, they had a Prussian background, and so did Rommel, so did Manstein, so did all the famous generals. The Prussian military school was the place that turned them out. And he was very much like Rommel. He served in the same units in the First World War. He was a thorough soldier. He was a career soldier, a lifetime soldier, again, as many of them around him were. But he didn't go out and court popularity. He was a soldier's man. Mm. And he, unlike Rommel and some of the others, didn't play the popularity card in order to become popular, familiar, or promoted with Hitler in his time. So he tended not to get too much glamour.
A lot of the officer class, I mean, Rommel's kind of, he's sort of middle class, isn't he? So he's sort of looked down, he's not from Prussia itself. He's sort of seen as like coming from Stevenage, if you like, in the officer. Is Bark nobility? Is he aristocracy? Because you can throw a
no. No, he's got a very similar background to Rommel too. He's a upper middle class, professional father, lawyer, and made his way up the greasy pole, if you like, of promotion. He sort of underplayed really in history. I think the most important thing to remember about people like Bulk is they were professional soldiers. They weren't there playing on their aristocratic violins. He didn't come from that sort of background. And again, like Rommel, he wasn't necessarily liked. I mean, we see Rommel in the West as quite a sort of superstar. The Germans don't see Rommel in the same way that we do. And they've not heard of Bulk at all. I mean, you know, the Second World War is not even on the German school curriculum. So, you know, those that have heard of Rommel wouldn't see him in the same way that we did. The myth of Rommel was created by us.
Yeah.
And it was created by us to, if you like, find an excuse why he was so successful in the Desert War, because we needed to create a myth around him as to explain away our own failings. So we created the myth of Rommel, and within Germany, he is not seen in entirely the same way at all. So, and Bulk is not heard of in any way.
So when is Bulk born? Is he sort of 1880, 1890?
Yeah, they were all born in that sort of period. To become a general a major general, your first divisional command, where you would, you know, it's a senior post, you had to be born around 1880 to 1885 to have made it to that rank by about 1939. I mean, they were obviously the field marshals. They were all another 10 years on. But it was very much a conveyor belt to jump the queue and to be promoted much faster than that. You had to be in the SS. The SS was a brand new army. It needed generals. They came out of nowhere. And that's a completely different story. And the rivalry between Bulk and these, you know, usurpers, if you like, is a big part of the book.
Because there is that ideology, isn't there, with the, you know, with the SS Panzer divisions and all that, which we can go into. First World War, again, very important part of any officer's story. He sees action. He's in the Balkans. Is he in Italy, yeah, as well? He's wounded seven times.
He's in the First World. Yeah. Well, he's in northern Italy and Austria.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he was a light infantryman. He was a Jaeger, you know, light infantry, reconnaissance infantryman in the front of infantry divisions. Very risky. He was always used to being at the front of his men. And was prepared to take risks and danger. He was wounded 9 times in his life. Most of those, I think 8 of those, were in the First World War. Lucky to survive, of course. But he was used to sort of leading from the front, and he did. Yeah, he served a little bit of time on the Eastern Front in Russia. You're right, in northern Italy and fighting where the Austrians had collapsed, and a little bit on the Western Front.
Fighting in Italy when the forces have collapsed might become a bit of a theme running through this into his later career. What does he do? Because obviously we have, you know, the armistice treaty at Versailles. What does he do in the intervening years then, say through the 20s? Is he staying?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. He's one of the lucky 4,000.
Yeah.
So von Seat, who was the commander in chief of the German army at the end of the war, he had 100,000 men given to him by the Treaty of Versailles, of which no more than 4,000 could be officers. And that's a fascinating little bit of research that I still really want to do. How did they select those 4,000? Was it on merit? Was it on background? Was it on family relations? Anyway, he made it through probably on merit and bravery alone and leadership. So, again, most of the senior German officers and most of the names that you will be familiar with in the Second World War were people that survived into the Reichswehr. If you didn't get into that first 4,000, your career was over, and then you were back to civilian life and had to restart at a later date. So you lost your part in the pecking order.
So what happens? I mean, Germany isn't allowed to rearm under the treaty, but of course they do, yep, secretly. I mean, they're starting rearming, yep, massively. You know, they're starting to rethink the way they're going to be doing war. How does Bart get his
how does he fit in?
Yeah, how does he fit in?
How does he fit in? Well, he's part of the government's reaction against the revolution in 1920, 22, 23.
Right.
He and his men who stay on.
Yeah.
He stays on unpaid, supporting the Weimar government, trying to keep sort of stability in Germany. And then during the rest of the 1920s, he works in a series of staff appointments and gets sort of quite bored, helping to sort of develop the very, very earliest new concepts of mobile warfare and tanks and tank designs. But he has a yearning to get back into sort of soldiering, so he then joins the cavalry. And that's where his link from being an infantryman in the First World War to becoming a tank commander in the Second World War, that's where it develops, because he rides a horse, and then, of course, the horses get changed and are traded in for tanks.
Ah, yes, but it's one of the great fallacies, isn't it? Because when you say mechanized warfare, you think Blitzkrieg, everybody goes, okay, and they immediately think Stukas and, you know, light tanks charging across Belgium and Holland and the whole thing. But in fact, that's only for propaganda purposes, because if you look at the makeup of the German army, and this is why I live alone, if you look at the makeup of the German army, it is, in fact, there are masses of cavalry units. They are still drawing light artillery via cavalry, via horse. The horse is a very important part.
Via horse, yes. Yeah, they're not masses of cavalry units, and you're right. I can see that you don't waste your evenings, but there are plenty of horses in the German army right through the Russian campaign. There was because the army expanded so rapidly with Hitler's plans after 1933. There was a time lag for trucks, and they never really caught up. They never had enough trucks to service the needs of all the new infantry divisions. They never had enough tanks. They didn't reach full tank production targets until the end of 1943, by which time the war was over. The war had been lost. So, yes, you're quite right. The horse was everywhere, and it provided meat, you know, when it had stopped pulling wagons. And bear in mind that the German army was large, but it wasn't large compared to someone like the Russian state, you know, and they were fighting on lots of different fronts.
Indeed, but the thing with the Russian, okay, well, let's just go quickly through 1940, you know, that is the Blitzkrieg, the Meuse. Now, if the French had learned, something about German tactics, is they like to come through the Meuse, you know, and they like to come through a particular crossing, and therefore, having learned nothing from history, they decide not to defend that vital ford, and guess what happens?
Well, I think you can interpret that in a number of ways. The Maginot Line had been built to reassure them that there was no need to watch the south. There was no need to watch the forests of the Black Forests and Alsace and Lorraine. And they only had to worry about Belgium because that was the flatlands. And if you had tanks, surely logic dictated that you were going to use them on flatlands and out in the open, not through forests and woods, which, of course, von Manstein came up with the plan to do that. Originally, the first plan did say that the main assault was in the north. It was von Manstein that persuaded Hitler to not do that. The sickle cut to the north was replaced by von Manstein persuading Hitler that they could get through the Ardennes.
Yeah, indeed. Now, it's all very well. I mean, it works spectacularly well when you're attacking Western Europe because you have train and railway networks, and here's another reason I spend my evenings, railway networks are vital to the Western approaches. I mean, they can get moved troops rapidly across large distances. Plus, if you are in a light tank and you're thundering around and you suddenly see the gauge going a bit sort of like low, you think, okay, well, I'll just pour into the nearest sort of French, the nearest French petrol station and say, you know, fill her up, mon chéri. That is great when you're attacking Western Europe. However, because you've decided to pick a fight with the Soviets, it becomes a little more complex with that because obviously Eastern Europe doesn't have an awful lot of, you know, they don't have loyalty cards if you are in the Third Reich heading east, do they? So this is where it starts to become unstuck. So explain a little bit about A, his role, and B, and this is going back to what happens before, he is in the front line. He gets up with his men. He doesn't just sit there in, you know, somewhere in the mosquito-infested wolf's lair and draw up big plans, does he? So explain a little bit about what happens next.
Well, I'm going to have to start listening to you for regularly from now on if we can carry on like this. Very impressive knowledge. One of the issues that the Polish campaign and the French campaign showed the German high command was that Blitzkrieg, if it was successful, caused them major logistical problems in that they could not keep up with the tanks. The infantry certainly couldn't, and they couldn't keep them supplied with fuel. And many of the halts and halt orders that came about were nothing to do with Allied action. They were to do with logistical supply. Now, this is pointed out to Hitler and is magnified on a exponential scale on the Eastern Front. And it's, you know, a miracle of supply and logistics that the German army managed to keep fighting at all. And very often, Bulk is out there cannibalizing fuel from trucks in the rear in order to keep his tanks moving. But he just compounds the problem.
And the other problem, is the fact that when they're going east, if you have combined, if you've got combined arms, so if you've got mechanized unit, you've got your half tracks, you've got your whatever you've got going. In the American army, for example, in the Allied armies, everything is standardized. So if something breaks on your tank, another tank will have the part that you can fix. Because of the nature of how the Germans construct everything by various little, you know, various little constructors doing, I'll do the tanks, you do the half track, everybody's trying to get it on the good books. So it means that if your half track breaks down, you can't cannibalize a half track that's come from Dusseldorf because it's a different manufacturer to the one that's been made in Bremen. And therefore, logistics are A, important, but once you break down, you are absolutely mucked. And that's a technical term.
Well, you've not left me much to say, have you? I mean, you've got it right in a nutshell there. I mean, it's not much point in having me on this show, to be honest. I think we just listen to your expertise because you're absolutely right. The only thing I can add is a little bit of detail, maybe, and that is that the problems of mechanization in the way that the Germans did it, which is individual companies building individual designs, was exactly that. That when they got to the front line, it was only those companies' spare parts that could be used. There was no standardized war production. by the time Albert Speer decided that this was obviously essential, as I said, end of 1943, it was too late. And you couldn't cannibalise. But also there was a problem with ammunition, because much of the German equipment that was used on the Eastern Front after 1941 had been captured in France and captured in Poland. And you often find infantry divisions, you know, needing logistical supply of dozens, literally dozens of different types of ammunition, because they were reusing Czech tanks, French artillery, Polish machine guns, and so on. And none of those were all standardized like NATO. They didn't all use the same barrels and bores. So there were enormous, intricate and difficult problems that tend to mask our image, if you like, of the smooth running Wehrmacht crushing and running. It wasn't like that at all. It was risky business. They nearly lost the war very, very early on, and people like Bolk knew that. They were sort of living day to day.
How does Bolk? Because people say, "Oh, well, you see, the problem was that they came across the Soviet army, and you had people like Zhukov." And, you know, who were able to outmatch them. Well, Zhukov shows the sort of the tactical awareness of a breeze block to the privates, because he will just slam into you with, you know, a couple of million men and go, because there isn't a tactic. It's just basically, there's a hill, off you go, Eagle, and we've got another, 500,000 Eagles behind you. So it is a sort of tidal wave. How does he counter that? How do you come up with a tactic for an enemy that really doesn't put an awful lot of value in human life, because it's for the greater good, it's a great patriotic war?
I think he found it very, strategically and tactically very difficult to deal with. Just the obvious comparison in numbers. Oh. I think he found. I mean, the Russians could just replace all the tanks that they destroyed on one day with the same amount of tanks the next day, and the same with men. And I think that Bolk, he did have a heart. But he was a tough soldier. He wasn't a murderer. Sorry, I'll get rid of that. He wasn't a murderer on the scale that some of his compatriots were. But he did struggle with the scale of destruction, the scale of extermination, really, if you like, of Russian soldiers. Mm. And so did his men. I mean, he commanded, his first divisional command was 11th Panzer Division. Top quality unit, and the men in there were used to fighting, and they were used to fighting hard battles, but they weren't used to, you know, just mowing down the troops and blowing up tanks day after day after day. Zhukov's problem, just to go back to that, was less a strategic decision by him, and rather a matter of necessity, because you, as you will probably know, much of the Russian trained military at the senior level, divisional level, had been purged in the 1930s. And the commanders that had come through that Zhukov had to order around didn't have the experience, and they hadn't been trained in modern warfare. So they were reverting to First World War tactics purely and simply because that was the most obvious thing to do. Towards the end of the war, Bolt was complimenting the Russians on how much they had learnt. Mm. He was in Cheer River Valley battles, where he made his reputation as the sort of fireman, the fire brigade division in that area post Stalingrad. He really did struggle when he came up against a chap called Popov, who did the same thing. He would appear and disappear with the same rapidity as Bolt.
Right, firefighting. Because what the Germans do in Italy, and with the Faustschläger and everything else, they've got these great troops, but the Hitlerian glare has come, and there is a warped ideology, which is why you've got the SS units, who are complete, I can't say the words, but they are driven by a different ideology to those of the army, and the death's heads, they all get the best, quote unquote, the best treatment. They get the snazziest uniforms. They have the worst human rights records. It's very difficult for the army, quote unquote, to deal with those differences, which is one question. And the other thing is, they've got great troops, but they don't use them properly. So, like Kesselring, for example, loves firefighting, loves getting little groups of, he's got, you know, three or four tanks together rather than 20 tanks together. And it's very easy for allies to pick off these little units who are being stuck here and stuck there rather than an overall strategy. Over to you. What do you think about that?
Okay, so we take the second question first. Italy was driven by the terrain.
Yeah.
Italy was driven by the awkwardness of the terrain not being suitable for large scale tactical movements, and also by that stage of the war. The Germans were struggling. If you think about, you know, the case of my father, he was making up the numbers in a German unit, and he was Polish. And there was a mixture of good units with reserve units and thrown together units.
Yeah.
And so when you've got these little pockets of what they called a Kampfgruppe, these little pockets of fighting troops, these little tactical units, that was really force majeure. They had no choice. We'd give them a complement of good soldiers, a complement of good equipment, and then the rest we'll have to throw in there. The divisional structure had gone. I mean, and the other problem that Bolk and other commanders like him faced was that if they had an SS unit under their theatre of command in their area, it was very unlikely they were going to take any notice of what he told them to do.
Yeah.
And that happened regularly and repeatedly, and people like Bolt would even take a plane to the Führer's headquarters, and this is why he never became a field marshal. And he was lucky, to be honest, to survive. I mean, you fall foul of Himmler, and Himmler's got Hitler's ear 24 hours a day, and he would say, I don't want that man to be promoted anymore. And Bolt survived through quite a lot of challenges to Himmler, but he was never going to get a field marshal's baton. That answers your second question. And I can't remember what the first one was now.
Here's the thing, though. I mean, it must be incredibly frustrating for him. And he gets fired, doesn't he? And then reinstated, because Hitler's just saying, we do not give an inch. This is Germany, and we don't give an inch. And therefore, you know, they're losing troops who have been trained at a horrendous rate for nothing. They should, you know, if they'd been a tactical brain in there, they would have fallen back to the Gothic line, you know, shore themselves up in the Dolomites and gone, you know, all right, over to you, Patton, have a crack at, you know, come and have a go in whatever that is in German.
This is all driven by and it sounds a terrible generalization, but there's a lot of truth in it, that Hitler's only experience of warfare was in the trenches of the First World War. And the only thing that tended to work in the trench of the First World War was a strong point.
Yep.
Full frontal assaults, manoeuvre, withdrawal and attack and all of that. The tactical warfare was lost on him. And my next book I'm writing at the moment is about Erich Hoeppner, who you probably will know as a panzer commander who was part of the July plot and was hung in 1944. Yep. He argued with Hitler that a war of manoeuvre was absolutely essential if they were going to win. And in 1941, as early as 1941, Hitler was saying no retreat, national socialism and commitment to the cause and sacrifice, no retreat will stop the Russians. And of course, that didn't work. People like Hoeppner couldn't handle it. People like Bolk could. But even Bolk by 1944, was back on the Ardennes going in the opposite direction, trying to, you know, hold a little bit of the Siegfried line. You know, he obviously gone quite nicely through in 1940, and he's back there 4 years later. And even he makes a small tactical withdrawal and loses his job. But by that time, Himmler was running that front. Hitler was so desperate to have, you know, completely committed 100% ideologues there fighting that Himmler basically sacked Bolt. But they still had him back even later when they really had trouble, because I don't know if you probably haven't read the book yet because it's not out, but Bolt's last command was trying to save Vienna, and that was Hitler's home.
Yeah.
And when he needed Vienna from the Russians, he reached out to his best commander, and that wasn't Rommel, because he was dead by then. and it wasn't von Manstein, because he was discredited by then, and it wasn't Kesselring, because he was exhausted by then. It was Bolk, and he put Bolk on the job of trying to save Vienna.
Interesting. And And luckily for them as well, because obviously the Allied forces decide that they're going to let the Soviets have Berlin, and then they swoop that way. So it's, you know, to Munich and through to Austria. So it kind of...
The best part of writing the book was at the end, and that was not because, you know, I was really, really finished with it. It was because it really started to get terribly interesting about the withdrawal from the Russians, you know, certainly on that southern area through Austria and up to the southern border of Germany. And I really wish I could have carried on with another chapter, if you like, but I was already 30,000 words over the limit.
Yeah, you've got to be real careful. How does he... So He survives. He's presumably captured by the Americans running towards going, take me now. How does he, rather than this, you know, giving his name to the Soviets, how does he survive the war in terms of he's not going to get, is there any threat of him getting done at war crimes? And again, people don't understand, it is complete chaos, even in Austria. I mean, the whole thing is broken down, people are trying to slip through. You know, Himmler's got his bunch of, you know, whatever it is, 30 Jewish people to say, look, I'm trying to save them, really, please don't shoot me. You know, Skorzenski's slipped through again, and he's currently going off to work for the CIA, apparently. What is his outfit? What is his out strategy? Because he does survive.
Well, he was thinking about his survival a good couple of months in advance. And he was letting down, is the best way I can put it, SS units and leaving them in the line to hold the Russians while he withdrew his sort of, you know, German troops, German army forces. And he was doing that and falling out and coming to terrible arguments and blows with other SS commanders who he commanded and left in the lurch, basically. And, you know, we can understand why, but that was a surprise to me. And he would, so he's planning from March through April and May to try and hold the Russians, to try and demonstrate to his superior officers in Berlin and to Hitler that he's doing what he was asked to do. But at the same time, he's strategically and gently withdrawing very quickly towards the Americans. He does not want to get captured by the Russians. He knew what that would mean. And he doesn't get captured. He surrenders to the Americans, and he very cleverly finds out through his reconnaissance forces who was opposite him towards the end, the last week of the war, in early May, and sends a message to a general, Major General McBride, who was he had fought before on the through the Ardennes, and they didn't know each other, but they knew of each other. And he said, you know, he was a commander of an army group by then. I mean, you know, we're talking about not divisions, not corps, not armies, but army group, that entire sector. And he said, I wish to surrender to you, but I'm not going to surrender easily. You know, I can continue fighting the Russians or I can just buckle. And of course, at that moment in time, it was all about territory. For Stalin, every yard counted. And even if he was going to crush his own soldiers, when the armistice came in, that's where the new Iron Curtain was going to be. There's an interesting annex in the book where I managed to find the complete transcript of their conversation when they met, and how McBride facilitated his surrender and helped him get his troops across the bridges that were left intact, but not the SS. They were throwing their equipment away and swimming as the Russians were arriving.
Marvellous. The book, I'm going to write it. I could talk to you about this until probably Thursday. The book is called Hitler's Forgotten Generals by Philip Rybuzhak. If people want to find you online, where's the best place? We've got about 12 seconds.
I've got a website. It's called philipkbujakauthor.com. And my books that I've written are on there, and the new book that's coming out next year will be on there. And so it's philipkbujakauthor.com.
And we'll get you on next year. Philip, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.